Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. I can't vote, neither can Ma. If a county goes wet, blame it on Pa. Prohibition once, prohibition twice. Statewide prohibition, isn't that nice? That was the rallying cry of the Sandyville Loyal Temperance Legion, based in Carroll County. Decades of protest by temperance supporters paid off in 1919 with the ratification of the 18th Amendment, meant to mark the end of intoxicating liquors. The amendment outlawed the production, transport, and sale of alcohol. While Maryland was the sixth state to ratify the amendment, the Free State was also the only state never to pass a state enforcement act. Here to tell us about Maryland's resistance to prohibition is Michael T. Walsh, author of Baltimore Prohibition, Wet and Dry in the Free State. Michael, welcome to On the Record.
Thank you. Nice to meet you, Sheila.
Prohibition lasted 13 years from 1920 to 1933. Did people stock up before the 18th Amendment went into effect?
They most certainly did. There was ample opportunity in the lead up to the enactment, or actually the implementation of the 18th Amendment, for them to purchase liquors, including hard alcohol, beer, wine, et cetera, and stock up their liquor cellars in the basement. And there's ample evidence, obviously, in Baltimore and Maryland and nationally of folks doing that.
Because the amendment did not bar drinking alcohol.
Exactly. One of the misnomers out there, I think, when you mention the word prohibition, is that all alcohol was illegal to even imbibe or consume. And that wasn't necessarily the case when you look at the actual text of the 18th Amendment. It's the manufacture, distribution of alcohol that's really the illegal activity. Possessing it in one's private residence, however, was not illegal. So therefore, if you're in your private residence and you're consuming alcohol, that wasn't a criminal activity.
And you could make gin in your bathtub.
And they certainly did.
When Maryland ratified the 18th Amendment, had areas of the state already banned the sale of alcoholic drink?
Yes, actually 21 of 23 counties had already voted to go dry by the time that the 18th Amendment was ratified and eventually implemented. So a good amount of Maryland, through what was called local option laws, there was a real push for local option from the 1890s through the mid-19-teens. And those were particular locales or areas through public referenda and at the polls could vote to actually go dry. Baltimore City and Baltimore County were the lone remaining
ones. Whole rest of the state had voted to go dry.
Yes. And one of the key points when looking at prohibition in this area is looking at the population. If you look at what Maryland's population was to Baltimore's population during this time period, looking at the censuses from 1920 and 1930, you see that you say 21 of 23 counties are dry, but then you look at the population and about half the population resides in Baltimore City. So you got to keep that in mind, I think, as you look at this amendment. Yes, most of Maryland has voted to go dry, but most of the population is in Baltimore City and Baltimore County.
But break it down to us further. In general, what groups in Maryland were on the wet side, what groups on the dry side?
There's many examples of both what we would call wets, which were the anti-prohibitionists, and the dries, who were vehemently for prohibition. Let's take a look, as an example, at religion as one aspect, if you will. For the most part, in looking at Baltimore and Maryland region, you can see that the Roman Catholic religion, for the most part, as a very general statement, supported Cardinal James Gibbons' viewpoint of being against prohibition. And his view kind of, and he was a very well-known cardinal, kind of represented the archdiocese, served in Maryland from 1877 to 1921 when he dies. And that view was basically that prohibition was seen as an injustice on one's personal liberty. It wasn't something that he felt really that government should be involved in. And then on the opposite side of that, because you have to remember the Catholics also use alcohol as part of part of their ritual, the transubstantiation, the blood of Christ, using wine for that. The other side of that are the Methodists, who are presented usually, and evidence shows, more of the teetotaling type, the major hierarchy in the Anti-Saloon League, which was the major interest group, were of Methodists. And H.L. Mencken, the famous Baltimore Sun editorialist, once called it the Methodist tyranny. And really, I mean, what he wrote, you wouldn't be able to say nowadays, but really went out after the Methodist. Those are just two examples of, in terms of pros and those who were against prohibition.
Was there an exemption in the 18th Amendment for alcohol used in religious rituals?
Yes, actually. So not in the 18th Amendment. So the 18th Amendment was passed, and then what the 18th Amendment didn't do was it didn't have an enforcement trigger or a mechanism. So the Volstead Act, Andrew Volstead of Minnesota in Congress, ends up proposing a bill that ends up being passed. So you have the 18th Amendment in conjunction with the Volstead Act. And the Volstead Act defines what an intoxicating beverage is, because the 18th Amendment says we're going to ban the transportation and sale and manufacturing of alcohol, but it doesn't tell you of an intoxicating beverage, but it doesn't tell you, well, what's an intoxicating beverage? And so what the Volstead Act does is it says, here's what an intoxicating beverage is. And it supports Section 2 of the 18th Amendment, which says that this will be enforced with concurrent power between the federal government and the state governments. And so that provides that enforcement mechanism that enables them to really enforce.
And so the Volstead Act gave a dispensation for alcohol used in religious rituals?
Yes, there was a carve out for two things, for like sacramental wines, for religious and spiritual aspects, and also for medicinal purposes as well. So we do see throughout the era of prohibition prescriptions that are written, as well as the government supporting certain distilleries remaining open, mandated by the government to make certain whiskeys and whatnot for medicinal purposes.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast, speaking with historian Michael T. Walsh, author of Baltimore Prohibition, Wet and Dry in the Free State. His book details the city's resistance to the ban on manufacture and sale of alcoholic beverages. I mentioned that Maryland never passed an enforcement act to ensure compliance with the 18th Amendment, while all the other ratifying states did. Why not?
Very good question. Yes, out of the 47 states that existed at the time, Maryland's the only one that doesn't pass what they call a baby Volstead Act. So you had the National Volstead Act, and then it was kind of intended for each state to kind of follow and mimic the language of the Volstead Act to ensure that the feds and the state governments were kind of acting in conjunction with each other, and that the enforcement of prohibition would also happen not only from the federal government level with the creation of the Prohibition Bureau, but also from the state providing some enforcement mechanism as well. Maryland decides not to pass it. There's debates. There's a few bills that are discussed and debated upon in the Maryland's General Assembly, one being the McBride bill that basically is a baby Volstead Act. There's another bill that's introduced. Ultimately, these two bills kind of competed against each other in the General Assembly, and neither of them end up being passed. And that's basically due to the fact that there was never a wholesale support in the General Assembly at the time
for
prohibition or this baby Volstead Act. And a lot of that falls along political representation. And Baltimore, by the early 1920s, was starting to exert more of its will and influence on the rest of the General Assembly.
So if there wasn't a baby Volstead Act in Maryland, did that mean state law enforcement didn't participate in enforcing prohibition?
Well, that's one of the things that Governor Albert Ritchie often talked about. He was a huge advocate of states' rights, that he felt that the implementation of prohibition, if you're going to enforce it, it would have to be at the helm of the federal government to come in and enforce it, that it was pervasive. It went against what a state's autonomy should be. He didn't want any part of it. Not passing that baby Volstead Act follows Ritchie's kind of thoughts, not only Ritchie, but some other politicians in the area as well. And true to form, the state really did not enforce or overly enforce prohibition. It was on the federal agents, the Prohibition Unit, the Prohibition Bureau, that's part of the Treasury Department, that's implemented by the federal government to come in and really enforce prohibition.
And did the federal government enforce heavily in Maryland?
Well, I mean, they had an active presence. They had their headquarters actually stationed right outside of Fort McHenry. So they had a prohibition headquarters right outside the gates of Fort McHenry. Unfortunately, that building no longer exists right now. And in the book, you know, I look at a crime a little bit and, you know, how the Baltimore police and the Prohibition Unit kind of reacted to crime. And you definitely, looking at the primary and secondary sources that are available, see that enforcement, if there was going to be enforcement, was done more at the federal level here in Maryland than by the local authorities.
Prohibition meant the end of breweries, saloons, distilleries. What impact did that have on Baltimore's economy?
Well, huge, huge impact. I particularly pay attention to, in my research, the breweries. And that has a lot to do with the influx of immigration during this period, too. German immigrants are the real proprietors of these breweries. And on the eve of Prohibition, I believe there's 29 breweries in Maryland. 23 of them are in Baltimore city limits. So a huge industry that's there. And most of these are owned by Germans, or German Americans. And when Prohibition goes into effect, part of the reason why Prohibition goes into effect is because of World War One. With America's entry into World War One, you had this anti-German fervor that really exists, and it helps the Dreyes at the national level really push their Prohibition agenda because it's anti-German. This is for the war effort. So you have the Lever Food and Fuel Control Act, Selective Service, that have certain Prohibition aspects or temperance aspects in these bills. And then the Wartime Prohibition Act is also passed that and this is in 1918, that limits the percentage of alcohol that's allowed. And ironically, this is passed, I think, 11 days after the armistice is signed. So the war is actually over, but they're passing Wartime Prohibition Act. And the impact this has on the breweries in Baltimore when Prohibition goes into effect is almost all of them end up having to close. Only a few remain open during Prohibition because they convert. It's, you know, idea of converting from alcohol or beer sales. The American Brewery, for instance, converts to, it becomes the American Malt Company. Gunther Brewery for a while produces near beer. So they have all the equipment in these breweries. Well, we can't produce a beer now at 3.5% or 4%, but we have the mechanisms to produce this at 0.5%. The problem is that's not a really economically viable product. People aren't running out to the stores to go buy 0.5% beer. I don't know how it tasted, but probably not as good as the full product before. So there was a book that was written back in the 1960s by William Kelly, that's Breweries in Maryland. And that really is some of the best evidence they have that's out there still on some of these pre-Prohibition breweries and really how Prohibition really killed this brewing culture in Maryland, as well as the distilling culture as well, you know, when you look at the hard liquors. And, you know, in looking at the history of it and where we are today, it's taken about 100 years. If you go right before Prohibition in the 1910s to where we are today in 2018, now we're starting to see craft beer, craft distilling. They're popping up all over the place in Baltimore and Maryland. But it's taken about 100 years to really come back to where we're getting a real Maryland influence on this industry.
Are there locations in Baltimore that can be seen today that were important during Prohibition?
Yeah, certainly there are. One of the, just as an example, a really neat location is the Repeal statue. It's right near Druid Hill Park. And it was dedicated on the day that Repeal happened, which was the rescinding of Prohibition, the 21st Amendment. And the statue has nothing to do, if you look at the actual image of the cherubs on the statue, of really anything necessarily to do with Prohibition, but because it was dedicated on that day and it was a celebration of the day, they've named it the Repeal statue, and so that's there. The Owl Bar in the Belvedere Hotel is still operating as a restaurant and bar to this day, and that was a speakeasy at the time.
The building that Humanum, the social
yes
enterprise operation, is in.
That's the American Brewery on North and Gay, I believe.
And did it continue operating during Prohibition?
So that was one of the companies that did. That was the American Malt Company that was converted to the American Malt Company. But yes, that was recently revitalized a few years back, and it looks great now.
You connect Maryland's opposition to the 18th Amendment to its nickname, the Free State. Explain that.
So Hamilton Owens was another Baltimore Sun newspaperman. Not as famous as H.L. Mencken, but pretty dignified in his own right. And in the early 1920s, he gave the state the moniker, the Free State. And that was, as he explained, given directly because of Maryland's defiance of Prohibition, that its refusal to follow federal law and this upholding of state rights, that it would remain free and of the yoke of federal pervasiveness over the state. So Hamilton Owens gives Maryland one of its more well-known nicknames.
Thanks for walking us through this history. Thank you.
Thank you, Sheila.
Michael T. Walsh is author of Baltimore Prohibition, Wet and Dry in the Free State. He'll be speaking and signing books on Saturday from 1 to 3 p.m. at BC Brewery, 10950 Gilroy Road in Hunt Valley. We've got more details at the On the Record page at WYPR.org. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. Quick break, and then a Stoop story.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.